Joel Blow, and you're listening to Talk Radio X.
CBS presents this program in color.
Hello, and welcome to the Radio Dan Show. Starring your host, Radio Dan.
Welcome once again. It's time for the Radio Dan Show. I am your host, Radio Dan. It's Sunday night. It is March 18th. How was your St. Patrick's Day, Jessica?
Sucked.
Wow. What? Okay. Well, anyway, welcome, intern Jessica, to the program. Jessica,
or do you want to know why it sucked?
That is my next...
Wow.
No.
I can't even believe you.
You didn't give me a chance to ask you.
You seem like you were moving on to the next thing.
As a matter of fact, I was not.
I don't believe you.
You can believe anything you want to. Why was your St. Patrick's Day not good?
I worked a double.
Oh, my goodness. A double what?
I worked from 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, I guess probably like 9:30 in the morning.
Okay.
Until 12 o'clock at night.
See, that's far more working than I have any interest in ever doing in my entire life.
And not only is that like a double shift, but
right?
It's like hard work, you know? It's like serving. It's lifting and carrying heavy, heavy trays back and forth.
Okay, so you have to explain. What is it that you do?
We work for a catering company.
Right, yes. Now, I did this for half the day with you. I did this for about 6 hours. So I guess my St. Patrick's Day was somewhat lousy as well, but nonetheless.
Although we did get to have some alcohol after work.
Oh, that's true. It's always nice to have a free drink here and there. All right, anyway, barring that, listen up, everybody. This is the program where we sit and we discuss the fun and wonderment of pop culture. And we talk about movies and television, and tonight we have a special guest on. In a little bit, we're going to bring on writer-director Richard Shepard, who brought us the film The Matador. He is currently working on a new movie called Spring Break in Bosnia. So we're going to hear him talk about both of those films, in addition to anything else that may be on his mind. But before we get to that, intern Jessica.
Yes? I was waiting for you to just go into it.
Is there anything that's on your mind?
Well, there is, actually.
Okay, please.
I am very excited because for one of the presents that we received during our wedding,
okay,
was for a bread maker.
Oh, how exciting.
I know that you think that this is not exciting because you're a stupid, stupid man.
Yes!
I'm telling you what, when I eventually have it make a loaf of bread, which will probably be like Tuesday.
Okay.
Or no, not Tuesday because I won't be home to enjoy it. But you could program this machine
right
to, like, let's say it takes 3 hours for it to make a loaf of bread, right?
Okay.
From start to finish. You could say, okay, don't start it until 2 o'clock. And then by the time we get home, it's done, hot, and ready.
Oh, my God.
And I'm telling you, everybody, right, even, like, guys in the office, they're like, oh, my God, my wife has a bread maker. And every time she makes bread, the house just smells so great, and the bread is just so good, nice and fresh. I mean, there's like cinnamon brown sugar bread, there's challah roll bread that I can make, and it's like
okay,
honey wheat bread.
Okay, fine.
Sourdough, rye, ugh, whole wheat, honey banana.
You're starting to sound like Bubba talking about shrimp in Forrest Gump.
Italian and French bread.
Okay.
7-grain, goodness. And you want to know something else?
No, please tell me something else.
What you could do with it as well is you could put it on like a pause, take the bread out, roll it in like seeds,
okay,
and then like continue cooking it so that it's like, you know, the one with lots of seeds all around it.
Like sesame seeds or something.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Oats. Sunflower seeds.
I'm so sorry I asked you today.
Ooh, zucchini bread.
Oh, my goodness.
Zucchini bread is so good.
What about banana bread? Is there a banana bread recipe with that?
Well, I said honey banana.
Oh, okay. I guess that's close enough.
You like the banana.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah?
All right, that's good. Does that mean...
No butter cinnamon rolls. Goodness.
No butter?
Oh, this is... The cinnamon rolls is what... What you do with this is it makes the dough for you.
Okay.
And then you take the dough and then you do the stuff you have to do to it and then bake it in the oven.
Okay, whatever. That sounds thrilling. Okay.
Also, it makes jam.
So sorry, everybody.
Spreading the jam, you know, like that short? That one real wonder.
You're just going on in different places. Anyway, you know what? This weekend was somewhat of a rarity for us because we sit here, we discuss movies all the time, right?
Yeah.
How often do we actually get out to the local cinemas?
Certainly not as often as we'd like to.
Right, and not as often as we used to, that's for sure.
We
used to go all the time, and now we sit here and we talk about movies, and we seem to not go as much. But we actually made it out there twice this weekend.
Yes, we did.
So the first movie we saw was Zodiac.
Yes, we did.
And Jessica, what did you think of Zodiac?
I thought the beginning was pretty good. I thought it was a little... You know, I don't know. For some reason, they think that you have to be graphic. You have to actually show, like, stabbing and shooting and faces being blown off. I understand that I'm probably a baby and that when you imply such things, maybe it doesn't make it as real.
Uh-huh.
But I don't want it to be real. I'm in a movie theater. I don't want to picture myself being stabbed.
But you're watching a movie about a killer who was real.
Yes. Well, that's what I'm saying. All right, fine. I want to see the movie, but I don't want to be the victim. I don't want to personify myself as the victim. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Also, a little long-winded in my
You mean it was a little opinion. Long?
Yes.
Okay.
Also,
uh-huh.
The movie takes this dramatic turn. We go from having the main character be kind of a background guy,
uh-huh.
just kind of watching everything go on, to a full-fledged, obsessed, wannabe contributor to the solving of who the Zodiac Killer is.
Okay, well...
And that's where it takes a turn. Why don't you explain what the movie's about?
All right. Now, the movie takes place... It spans a lot of years, okay? It starts out in 1969 is where it starts out.
How long you feel like you're in there for, too.
One thing that's very cool, and I think helps set the tone, for me at least, I always like when movies do little touches like this. It opens with the 1970s version of the Paramount logo.
That was great.
It really puts you into that mood. You know, it kind of, look, they're going for an overall feeling with this, right? The Zodiac murders start in Northern California, and the first half of the film is more like a police procedural. You're running around with some cops, Mark Ruffalo and Anthony Edwards, and they're going about the whole task of investigating the crime and what's going on. And you also have the other aspect. You have the newspaper people who are involved because the Zodiac is sending them letters, and you've got a newspaper reporter who's played by Robert Downey Jr., who was heavily involved as well. Jake Gyllenhaal, who's your top-billed actor in the movie, is a cartoonist who works at the San Francisco Chronicle alongside of Robert Downey Jr. And they investigate the movie. I'm sorry, they investigate the crimes as the murders pile up, and they do. They pile up as the movie goes along, and they get suspects, and they're following leads and this and that. And one thing that's very important that you should know going in is that they didn't really solve this. Now, I've known this, was that the Zodiac murders have never been solved, okay? And at a certain point in the film, Gyllenhaal's character decides to take upon his own investigation. And at this point, the movie really changes its focus. It's a tonal shift, and it's a total shift in gears. All of the characters that you've seen so prominently in the first half of the film are really relegated to very small parts in the second half of the film. Kind of reminds me of the movie The Insider, in which the first half of the movie you are spending almost entirely with Russell Crowe, and the second half of the film you spend with Al Pacino. Remember in that
mm-hmm.
film?
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of that.
I forgot all about that, but that's a great analogy.
for me, what I really like about this movie, and that it primarily takes place in the 1970s, is that you really get a feel for the time and the place. And you really feel like you are in 1970s San Francisco. And I like that. I really kind of feel that, especially for a movie of this type, any kind of crime drama, I think for some reason, you said a crime drama in the 1970s and it seems right at home.
Well, I tell you what, it had a very cool feel, yes. But I just don't think an unsolved case that spanned for so many years is an interesting subject. It was interesting in the fact that he wrote letters and that he was such an evil man, whoever this guy ended up being, you know? But there's no closure. It's like writing a movie without an ending. Don't you agree?
No, I don't agree. I don't agree because I'll give you another example of a film that's like that. Now, say what you will about the actual facts of this particular case. The movie, cinematically speaking, JFK, is a movie that does not give you any particular closure like you're talking about, but on its own is an exceedingly fantastic film. I think JFK is one of the better films of the 1990s.
It's hard to put your 100% feelings and heart and mind and body into such movies and leave without answers. Even JFK, I remember thinking, because I was young when I saw it, I was like, this was such a good movie. But I'm missing it. I want to know who did it. I mean, you don't feel that at all? You're like, yep, I accept it. We don't know.
Well, I don't
say... You'd be a liar different.
Right. You're right. I do understand that, but I also understand that they're giving it to us as best they can. That does not mean that this story is not worth telling. The case of the Zodiac Killer is certainly interesting enough that it deserves a retelling, don't you think?
An adaptation, maybe.
Well, what do you think that was?
Well, I mean, an adaptation, an adapted ending as well.
Oh, so like they should like make up an ending?
Yes, because they're telling a story. How many books, how many adaptations to things? Forget real life.
Right.
Do they change around all the time? And I'm talking changing endings. But because something is real, because it's based off of something real, we can't give it a closure. You're a freaking movie studio. You can make this reality whatever you want. You can pretend that the Zodiac Killer showed up in an Easter Bunny costume and said, please arrest me. Here's all the proof you need to convict me.
All right. First of all, the killer in the Easter Bunny costume was already done in an episode of The Jeffersons. That two-parter where he wore the horn-rimmed glasses, that creepy guy.
That is so strange.
Yes, it was very strange. I know.
It's strange that I should mention that.
Exactly.
I didn't come up with that.
I know. So don't bring that up because I get nightmares when I think about that guy. Anyway, you're right. Okay, there is two schools of thought on that. You can go ahead and just make up your own ending, and it's a total Hollywood BS kind of thing. But I suppose for entertainment's sake, it could be fun. But that's not what this movie was going for. You have to understand that.
But a movie is a movie. Do you understand that? See, that's what... All right, yes,
no,
fine.
No, okay, but there's different kinds of films. There's different kinds.
There's the kinds where we don't like endings. There's kinds where we don't want to be entertained. That's what a movie is.
But this was a movie that was trying to show you what it was like for these people in this time. They were going through the police procedural in the first half of the film, and they were going through the obsession of the writer in the second half of the film. They should not go ahead and give you a phony ending. Oh, yeah, and by the way, Jake Gyllenhaal shot him in his pajamas on April 30th of 1980.
I guess you have a point with showing what they're going through. But it sucked. I don't care to know what these guys went through because it sucked. I don't want to feel it. I don't want to – it's one of the only times in a movie where you can actually feel what they're feeling. You leave the movie just as confused as they are. And you want to know something? It's so hard to watch a movie like that after being such an avid like Law and Order and CSI fan, because these people convict people, and I know it's just a show,
right?
But these shows it makes it seem like you can't even be in the same, you know, room. There's you could be in a plastic bubble and kill someone, and they'll still find you.
Well, good. See, a little dose of reality for you. But then again, this is the 1970s that they're investigating. They don't have the same technologies.
But it went all the way up to the 90s.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So that's where it was hard to do.
All right.
And they had all this evidence against one guy.
There is a particular suspect. You do get, I don't agree with you in that there's no closure. They give you as much closure as you can get from that film, I think. So, I really don't agree with you in this at all. Personally, it's the best movie I've seen so far this year, which isn't saying much. I haven't seen a lot. But I think at the end of the year, this is going to be one of those movies that people talk about. People will remember that this movie was as good as it was.
Now, I will definitely say that I know that I am in the minority. It's not like I didn't like the movie. Like I told you 2 seconds ago, I appreciate it. But the shift in the middle of the movie is so great, you know? And I don't...
Look, basically, you're unhappy with the shift, you're unhappy with the non-ending, you're unhappy because you're a big baby. That's what it is. So if you want to listen to Jessica, you'll not enjoy Zodiac. If you want to listen to me and, you know, be intelligent about these things.
Maybe if I would have known going into it that it wasn't happening.
Yes, okay, there you go. Everybody out there, the Zodiac Killer was never solved. They never solved it. Now you know. All right.
That could be my own fault, though, for not being in the know.
Okay, we also saw Black Snake Moan earlier today.
Yes.
And it was okay.
It was okay. It was very indie.
It was very indie, and it's very much a two-person character piece. And I was hoping it was more of a little bit on the exploitation side of things, where you see Sam Jackson chaining up Christina Ricci to a radiator and keeping her because she's some sort of out-of-control nymphet. He finds her beaten up outside his southern home. I don't know what southern state it is. Fill in the blank. Let's say it's Alabama.
Okay. Okay.
So he finds her outside. She's beaten up, and she's not barely wearing any clothes. So he decides to nurse her back to health. But then he sees that she's got all kinds of issues, and he says, well, here's one way to cure her. I'm going to chain her to a radiator until all the wickedness goes out.
Well, I think the whole idea was, I'm going to force her to stay with someone who's going to respect her.
Well, yes, but I like my synopsis of it better.
But she was so weird. Like, she had issues. Like, she had legitimate, she had legitimate nympho
issues.
Yes. She was literally like, yes, everybody in the world, bang me, please.
Yes, she had to have it.
Yes,
she had to have it.
Unlike so many other cases, was asking for it.
Okay, you know what? How about we go ahead and bring on Mr. Shepherd on? What do you say?
All right, sounds good. But we will talk about it more. We will talk about sake more
later on
in the show.
Okay, let's bring on Mr. Shepherd.
I really liked it.
And we'll see if we have any time at the end of the show. What we'll do is we'll go over the box office.
Hello.
Hello, Richard.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
It's good to be on.
I am here with my co-host, Jessica. Jessica, say hi to Richard Shepherd.
Hello, Mr. Shepherd.
Hey, Jessica, how are you?
I'm doing good. I have to say, it's very funny. I'm going to make a confession. We watched the director's commentary today of The Matador, and it's funny to be talking to you after listening to the movies.
After listening to my nasal voice thrown on for 90 minutes.
All right, well, you have heard Radio Dan, right?
Where are you guys located?
We are in Coral Springs, Florida.
Ah, beautiful.
Yes, it is, quite.
Yes, I'm in beautiful, sunny California. I'm actually on a tennis court, which is very Hollywood in L.A., though I like to think of myself as a New Yorker and not very Hollywood in L.A., but I'm actually sitting on a tennis court.
Oh, I like that we're calling the big Hollywood director, and he's sitting on his tennis court.
It's not mine. It's a public court.
That would have been good, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got a question for you there, Richard. How did the story of The Matador come about for you?
Well, I've always been fascinated by hotel bars. I've traveled a lot for my work, and I always end up in a hotel bar at around 11 or 12 at night. And I found that at hotel bars, you can actually have a conversation with someone more intimately, maybe, than you would at, like, your neighborhood bar, because you know you're never going to see them again. And so you can tell them stuff you wouldn't say to someone who you might run into. And so I sort of thought that was a good starting off point. And then I just sort of wrote the very first scene where Pierce and Greg Kinnear meet in the hotel. That was the first thing I wrote, and I just sort of, I had no idea that Pierce would be a hitman. I had no idea anything. Pierce's character, I just sort of wrote the scene, and it sort of developed, and somehow a story came out of it.
Well, I like that.
Not the most normal way that you go about necessarily writing a script.
Well, you know, as long as you end up with something like the Matador, you do it however way that you see fit.
God bless you.
I think when we originally saw it in the theaters.
Right.
And I left it thinking it was such a good movie. And listening to the commentary today was so great because, you know, you get a lot of answered questions. Like, I'll give you a little one of myself.
Okay.
At one point, Pierce Bronson leaves Greg Kinnear a pamphlet, and without giving any sort of when it's located, I thought that it was a ticket for him to join him.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
It's amazing. Well, you know, on a if it had been a major studio movie instead of an independent film, we probably would have reshot that once people sort of got confused. But we didn't have the money to. it just ends up being confusing.
It was funny because I remember thinking, wow, maybe they're gonna like do stuff together like all the time. They'll be flying together everywhere.
Well, we were joking that there's a sequel in the movie somewhere where Pierce is living in Greece now, and the doorbell rings, and Hope Davis is there, and she's like, Danny's been kidnapped, and suddenly, yeah, this is the ongoing joke in the while we were shooting. Of course, there will never be a sequel, but it's nice to think about those things.
So let me ask you about Julian Noble. This guy he's a degenerate, and he's a pervert, and he's a killer, but yet we like him. Why is it that we like him despite all of these qualities?
You know, I think it's a testament to Pierce Brosnan's performance in a way, because, you know, I wrote him to be as unlikable as humanly possible, but somehow have a little bit of soul in him. And Pierce just has that soul to the point where you kind of love him even though he's despicable. And I sort of found that if you cast actors who are inherently likable, you can actually have them do anything and an audience will sort of, you know, be with them, short of, you know, killing a child or something absolutely horrific. But they can be a general, you know, a sex addict or this or that, and people will go along with it because they like the actor. And Pierce just has so much inherent charm that he sort of made these lines that maybe out of a different actor would have just been very unfunny. He somehow made them actually funny because, you know, you can't believe he's saying it.
Well, I tell you, there was a lot of times during the commentary where you were stating how this scene was going to be darker, that scene was going to be darker. For instance, he was in the hotel room watching the old musical, and instead he was going to be watching the news footage of him on his last job. And I couldn't help but totally agree with you. You ended up making the movie and his character so likable and so dark comedy.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's part of why I love editing as a part of the process of making a movie, because you sometimes find the movie, hopefully, if you're lucky, you find the movie that is meant to be found. I mean, in the original cut of the movie, it was a lot darker, and people wanted to laugh. They were laughing, but then they would go through huge periods where they weren't laughing at all, and that wasn't working. So we just sort of said, you know, we can still get the same character stuff, but maybe we can lighten this up just a little bit. It's still dark, but at least audiences can know that they can smile here. And it's a part of the process. You know, the first cut of the Matador was a good 30 minutes longer than what you saw and significantly darker and sort of just eventually found its shape. I'm cutting a movie right now and we're going through the same process of finding the exact right tone, when to go too dark, when to mm-hmm. funny, when to be serious. And that's not an easy thing, which is why when you make a movie that mixes comedy and drama or thriller, It's difficult. You know, a straight-ahead comedy, it's either funny or it's not. Or a straight-ahead thriller, it's either scary or it's not. But when you mix the two, you've got to sort of make a successful version of both of those things. And so, you know, it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good job.
Thanks. Now, thank you.
Now, this is such a departure for Pierce Brosnan. How did you get him on board to play this character?
Well, you know, I never really thought that any big star would do it, you know, because as we were just saying, he's sort of despicable, he's mean to children, and he sleeps with anything that walks, and all of this sort of stuff. And I basically wrote it expecting to just make it as an ultra-low-budget little digital movie, and it was very liberating, in fact, writing a movie where I didn't think that there was any commercial viability at all. And somehow Pierce, we sent the script to Pierce's production company, because I was looking for a writing gig, and they were looking for a writer for a project, and somehow through a series of events it ended up on his desk, and suddenly the next thing I know he's calling me in New York saying, hey, I've read this script and I want to be in it and I want to produce it and I want to make it for a lot more than, you know, a digital movie. And those phone calls rarely, if ever, happened, never happened to me before like that.
Wow.
That's just one of those Hollywood stories.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, he sort of found me and found this script and, you know, changed my life. I mean, is as simple as a phone call, you know. And so it just sort of suddenly, when he wanted to do it, it became a whole different thing. You know, it was no longer, you know, suddenly we were able to find some money and all of this other stuff that we would have never been able to do before.
So after you get Brosnan on, then you're able to go out and hire Greg Kinnear. Is that when that happens after?
Well, you know, Pierce basically said, who do you want in this movie? And I just basically picked the two people I wanted, which was Greg Kinnear and Hope Davis. And we ended up offering it to them, and they said yes. And that rarely happens as well. It was one of those, you know, I think making a movie is so difficult. It takes years, and some movies are blessed with some luck and some aren't. It's not necessarily the quality of the project. It's just like the stars are aligned, and Pierce wanted to do a comedy film and something different, and Greg had just done something very serious and wanted to do a comedy, and Hope had been doing all these dramas and wanted to do something light. And so we were able to find these three actors at the right time and at the right sort of project, and they said yes, and, you know, it was pretty amazing.
Speaking of Hope Davis, I was wondering, when I saw The Matador, I think that was after American Splendor, correct?
Correct, yes.
That was the only thing I had seen her in. Where did you get her as the character?
I loved her in American Splendor and in a few other roles, The Secret Lives of Dentists, which is a small movie she was in, and a bunch of stuff I had seen her in. And then we were trying, once Pierce had called and said, hey, I want to do this, we decided to have a reading of the script in Los Angeles just to hear it out loud and basically get Pierce to actually commit to, you know, signing a piece of paper and really commit to doing it. So it was a little bit of a sales thing. We were just going to read the script out loud. And we asked our casting people just to get some people to read the other parts. And she said, hey, you know, Hope Davis is in town because her husband's doing a pilot or something, and she's read the script and she'd love to come in and just read at this round table. And she did. And at the end of the reading, I went to Pierce. I said, well, I'm not sure if you're going to do this movie, but I know that if we ever make it, I'm going to hire Hope because she was just so funny. Mm-hmm. And so she almost, like, she sort of got herself the job in a way. You know, it was sort of like it was a 90-minute audition. You know, it was perfect.
That's awesome.
Wow.
I love her character in this movie. She seems like such a cool wife.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make a pro-marriage movie, which is, it sounds a little strange, but I think that a lot of times in movies, they just show married couples are always just sort of bickering and fighting and this and that. And I just was like, you know, maybe we should just have a married couple who kind of likes each other, you know, and maybe that'll be sort of interesting. And maybe one of the tensions in the movie will be the hope, the audience's fear that that Pierce is going to make a pass at her or do something horrible. Because you know that it would be just deadly. It would be the worst thing you could imagine if he did that. And so it sort of adds a tension level to those scenes in the second half of the film, you know, just because you like them so much as a couple and you don't want something to get in between them, such as, you know, Pierce, who clearly she has a slight crush on.
Yeah, no, it was great. Especially, like, nowadays, even on television, you have all these shows where every time I see them, I can't help but, as a female, think, God, these ladies are such bitches.
Yeah. You know? It's true. It's, you know, I don't know why it is. I think it's just cheap, you know, bad, easy writing. And it's not, you know, I was just sort of like, it was a challenge to just sort of, listen, let's just write a couple where they like each other, you know? Maybe that'll be actually different.
Great concept.
You know, it's, yeah. I remember thinking that when I'm watching it. I was like, you know, it's actually kind of cool that this couple really does. They're really in love, and you can tell, and that's just so rare.
And they tell each other stuff.
Right, yeah, and they're with each other. Why is that strange?
It's like alien to everybody.
It is. It just shows you the sign of the times.
Exactly.
But back to Brosnan's character, one thing that I really enjoy about him is his look. Those suits that he wears, they're just great.
Yes, he's, well, you know, the costume designer of the movie was a woman named Kat Thomas who had costume designed Kill Bill. And the reason she got the job on The Matador was she basically came into her interview and she said, I want Pierce Brosnan, everything that he wears, to be a half size too small. And I was just like, wow, that's such a really interesting character thing. It just, he's sort of this guy who's like really out of step and out of date and sort of a little, he's odd, he can't fit in. And so putting Pierce in those outfits, I mean, he looked fantastic, he looked so sleazy in them. And the fact that they're just a little tight, you know, makes it even just something even more off, you know, especially since we're so used to seeing Pierce always so perfectly put together in all the other movies he does.
I think that that added so much to it, the fact that it was Pierce Brosnan walking around like that.
Exactly. And then when he's in his underwear, too.
Oh, my God. When he was walking through that lobby in those boots and practically nothing else.
Yeah.
It was so funny to me.
I wanted him to just be in the bathing suit or the underwear, and he was like, well, I'll only do it if I can wear the boots. Which is actually the funniest part of the whole thing, by those boots, so, yeah.
That was great.
Now, since you got this film made independently, how much interference do you think that you would have gotten had this been a studio film?
Well, it just would never have been made in that capacity. I mean, at the time, it would never have been made with me directing, first of all, because I had, even though I'd made some small little independent films, I had done nothing that was in remotely like The Matador, and I don't think that they would have let me do it. And I certainly don't think that they would have not wanted Pierce to be such a lout, you know, so uncouth and such a fucker. They would have graded up a little bit and made him a little nicer and a little smoother, and they probably wouldn't have let him have a mustache, and they probably wouldn't have let him be in those clothes. And it would have just not been an interesting movie. You know, I'm thrilled you guys like it, and for the people who do like it, I think it's because it is just slightly different than the normal stuff you see. But, you know, the studios have, you know, they have a recipe that they do, and they expect to make a certain amount of money, and they don't like to take risks. And that's why I love making movies independently, because you don't have as much money. You know, The Matador was a $10 million, $11 million movie, as opposed to a $40 or $50 million movie. And that was a lot of money for me, but not a lot of money in the terms of the way they make movies normally. And so that $10 million, because it wasn't a lot of money, allowed us to do whatever the hell we wanted. And the fact that Pierce was a producer and backed the idea of doing something pretty different for him, it also gave us the freedom to just do it. You know, I mean, no one was going to stop us.
Very cool.
So since this is an independent film, is this the director's cut, the one that's out there?
Yeah, I mean, the movie that I made is the movie that we ended up screening at Sundance, and the movie that we ended up selling to Harvey Weinstein, and then the movie that got released. It is indeed my cut. There is no other version of the movie that exists, which, you know, is awesome.
That is awesome. It's rare.
I tell you, it's so sad to hear, like, stories or commentaries where the director just seems so unhappy.
Well, you hear it too, you know, but listen, if someone's paying, if you're making a movie for $50 million, then you're being paid, you know, $1 million or even more than that. And then you, at a certain point, you sort of sell your soul off. I mean, a little bit. It's like you're getting paid more money than most people make in a lifetime. So stop your complaining and do what the studios want to do.
Wow,
and, that's
such but if you're
making a movie for, you know, $10 million, then you're really not making that sort of money at all. You're making barely enough to survive. And I worked 4 years on that movie altogether. And if you spread out what I made on that film over 4 years, it's really not much at all. But I got to do the thing I wanted to do. So you sort of, you know, trade off. But when you know, at a certain point, if you're making independent films, you're not doing it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most interesting stories out there is good old Harvey Keitel, who will do a real crappy movie for a lot of money so that he can do the good indie films that he likes.
Exactly. Well, I think a lot of these actors do, and I think that's actually becoming more and more normal, is that you get these actors who will do some sort of big-budget movie, but in a way they're doing it just to allow them to do more interesting stuff where they're not getting paid, you know, a ton of money, but they get to actually act, you know, which is what they originally got in the business to do.
I'm telling you, I'm so glad we got into, you know, that the movie industry got into independent films as opposed to, like, B-films and Hollywood films, you know what I'm saying?
You mean, like, the it becoming more of a mainstream acceptance, I suppose?
Exactly.
They started to see that they could actually make money off of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that in a way, it was actually perfect because they could get movies that might be more interesting, that might end up winning some Academy Awards or stuff like that, but they don't have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Now, and it's a blessing for both sides of the equation, you know. The only people that really hurts at this point are people who are making a movie for under $1 million who can't afford to have any name actors in their movie because so many independent films now are actually starring famous people.
That's so true.
That it's hard now for the sort of up-and-coming people who have a great story to tell but just don't happen to have access to money. But I think the Internet's going to change all of that. I think you're going to start seeing really interesting film. Well, you already are, but you're going to start seeing a more commonplace thing where you're going to find independent filmmakers who can't afford much of anything, but they can afford a DV camera and an editing system on the Internet, making a movie that people are going to see. And in a way, that's how the next generation of filmmakers are going to break out, because the idea of making a regular movie that's going to screen in theaters that stars no one famous is becoming less and less of a reality right now, I think.
Wow, that is so true.
So let me ask you this, Richard. After you finish the film and you're heading to Sundance.
Yes.
Now, you haven't sold it at this point, but you know you've got a great film. You've got Pierce Brosnan. You've got Greg Kinnear. How are you feeling going in to Sundance? Are you feeling like, wow, I've got a full house here?
I felt the exact opposite. I felt absolutely nauseous and terrified. I mean, we had screened the movie and people seemed to like it, but there's a difference between, you know, these little screenings and suddenly screening it in front of 1,000 people at Sundance, in which the entire audience is made up of film critics, film distributors, and filmmakers. It's a really it's a tough crowd. They love movies, and if your movie's good, they will love it. But if it's not good, they will really not love it. And, you know, it's terrifying. I mean, you know, for me, it was a really huge opportunity to make the movie, and here was the opportunity. We had to sell it there. We had to make sure, you know, I always knew that because Pierce was in it, we would make some sort of, if it was horrible, it would still come out on DVD or be on Cinemax or something because he's famous. But
right.
There's a difference between that and actually having a movie that comes out and is, you know, well received. And, you know, for me going into Sundance, it was scary, but, you know, it was a real dream situation and we ended up selling it, and it, you know, it changed my entire life. It changed my career because suddenly I went from some guy who made a little obscure movies that people kind of liked but no one really saw to a movie that at least got, you know, good reviews and was seen by people and well regarded, and it changes your perception. And so, you know, everything positive that could have come out of that movie has come out of it, except for my share of the profits, which I have yet to see.
Oh, goodness. Well, congratulations on everything else. My fingers are crossed for you, though.
That's why I'm at a public tennis court.
So once you sell the film, now I noticed that before this movie came out, I had been to richardshepherd.com and I had seen a poster for The Matador that had a look of an old, like a poster for an old like an old bullfight.
That's right.
And it you know, it was like a coming soon, and it had the name. And I remember, wow, this looks really cool. Now, once you sell it, the ad campaign like changes. Like, there's different posters that's up. Are you involved in any of that at all?
I am. You know, the people at Harvey Weinstein's company, the Weinstein Company, were really good in involving me in, you know, as much as one can. It's, you know, this is their jobs, their marketing people, and I disagreed with a lot of the things they did, and yet at the same time I loved a lot of the things they did. But I said they were very nice to allow me to participate. But at a certain point, you know, that poster you're talking about, which was sort of a bullfighting poster, you know, that was ultimate. That was great while we made the poster while we were shooting the movie, and it was really fun to have something like that. But at the end of the day, they needed to come up with a way to market it and a way to get people in. And, you know, one always second guesses everything, and I certainly think that in retrospect, we probably did some things wrong with the release of The Matador, even though it did rather well. It was not a gigantic, you know, blockbuster hit. But at the same time, you know, it's just one of those rolls of the dice. You know, it's tricky. So I love all of the posters. I have like a collection of all these strange posters, you know, from Indonesia and, you know, from Spain and all of these different posters for the movie that are really, you know, they're really cool. They're, you know, sitting in a box somewhere, but it's fun to have them.
Our little keepsakes. I have one more question about the Matador.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a great title. It's cool how the bullfighting is kind of, you know, in the way background, but still peppered in. Like, what made you think of that from the hotel conversation between two characters? What made you tie in?
Well, you know, the fact is that I had done a little independent film in Mexico City a few years before, and I had such a great time there that I wanted to go back. And so I wrote, like, every script I wrote after that movie took place, part of it took place in Mexico City. And this, because I was hoping one of them would get made and somehow I could go back. And this one, so, you know, I started writing the bar scene, and the first thing I wrote was interior Mexico City bar. And then once I started writing the movie, it seemed like a perfect thing for them to do, which is go to the bullfights, because it's such an important part of being in Mexico, I think, is going to a bullfight and seeing how the people there react to it. And then my wife actually came up with the title, The Matador. It was her idea.
Oh, very cool.
Because Matador means killer. And so since Pierce is a killer, it seemed to make some sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what, too? I do recall you talking about on the commentary about how it kind of also tied into Bronson's character about how, you know, bullfighting ended up, you know, kind of losing its charm nowadays, and it's like he was going through kind of the same thing.
Right, it's sort of, you know, certainly bullfighting is of another time. It's sort of past its prime, and Pierce's character is definitely of another time and past its prime. So there was a lot of symbolism to that, and, you know, it turned out to be great because, you know, we were able to shoot these bullfights and use them in a way that, you know, still captured the beauty and majesty of it, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's sort of a faded glory because, you know, the things are vicious and eventually they're going to be banned completely.
Yeah.
But they still exist now and we can't deny that.
That's true. Now,
Richard, you're not, it's funny because I think you're probably new to a lot of people in the, you know, film fans, but you're not really new to directing. You've been making movies for quite some time. In fact, I've seen the Linguini Incident.
You're the only one. Congratulations.
Okay. So let me ask you, why do you think, it's taken you so long to break through?
Well, you know, I've had a very odd career. I've been able to make these little movies. I made a movie called Oxygen about 8 years ago with Adrian Brody was in it and Maura Tierney, who's on ER, and I produced some stuff, and I've managed to just somehow make a living really below the radar of the Hollywood system. And, you know, no one opens the door and shuts you in Hollywood. You really have to prove yourself and you have to, you know, fight your way in. And, you know, I was able to make a living and learn my craft. And so by the time The Matador came, I was actually rather experienced, even though to most people it's the first thing they've ever seen of mine. So I got to make a first movie again. You know, I got to do it. I got to have my first movie a second time. And where the Linguini Incident was not a particularly successful movie on any level, because I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. By the time the Matador came around, I actually kind of knew enough of what I was doing to feel confident to make the movie. And then suddenly people are like, oh wow, this is really cool. And you're in. They've opened, somehow the door's open. But it's a very tricky business. It's not a business where, you know, you can just kind of waltz in. But they, you know, Hollywood does respect at the end of the day either good reviews or box office. And our movie thankfully had the former. I wish it had more of the latter, but it still had enough. It had enough for people to suddenly go, okay, you can join our little, you know, weird fraternity.
So, Richard, tell me, what is Spring Break in Bosnia?
It is a movie that I'm in the middle of editing right now, and actually the title of it's going to change. We're still trying to figure out what we're going to call it. But it is a movie that stars Richard Gere and Terrence Howard, who was the star of Hustle and Flow, and it is a dark comic adventure, a true story about the hunt for the most wanted war criminal in Bosnia 5 years after the end of the war there. And it's a true story about how these journalists sort of started tracking him down, and because they were getting so close to him, they are mistaken for a CIA hit squad. And it's weird. It's tense. It's scary. Hopefully, but it's also funny because it's a kind of a black comedy in a way about why no one seems to be catching any of these war criminals, even though they all say that they want to catch them. So we just finished shooting the movie in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, and Croatia, and we're cutting it. And hopefully, you know, it seems like we're going to be opening at some point at the, you know, in the fall.
Okay, that's fantastic. All right, now let me ask you: you're making a fairly politically charged kind of film there about Bosnia. In Bosnia?
Yes.
Was there any difficulty with that?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, the press had a field day. I mean, half the press, you know, it supports this war criminal who's on the run, and so they're not very happy that we're shining a light on him. And the other half of the press was very excited because we were making a movie in which we were challenging the fact that the United States and the rest of the European Union and NATO all claim they want to catch these guys, but no one really catches them. You know, the most wanted war criminal in Bosnia, the man we're making our movie after, has been on the run for 10 years in a country the size of Kentucky, and during that time, he's written 2 books and a play.
Oh, my gosh.
He's working more than I am, and yet we can't seem to catch up. I mean,
that's amazing.
So it's sort of fun. It was a great shoot, and I think people are going to be blown away by Richard Gere's performance. It's a really different role for him, and sort of another case, a little bit like Pierce, in that we cast someone who's very likable in a dark role, and it's an interesting thing to see, you know, Richard Gere being kind of a scumbag, but it works.
That sounds great. I'm looking forward. That's in the fall.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow.
A different name. I'll let you know when we figure out what we're going to call it.
Okay, fantastic. I have one more question for you.
Sure.
I am always curious about the actual writing process, the creative process. Is there any particular thing that you do each time when you're writing your screenplays?
Well, you know, most people will tell you that you need to have an outline, you need to have a treatment, you need to have an idea of what your movie's going to be. And I would tell anyone who's starting out writing that that's the case. What I've done in the last few years is basically done none of those things, that I just start writing without having any idea what the hell is going to happen and let my characters take me where they want to go. And let me tell you, sometimes that produces an unreadable piece of shit. But sometimes it produces something interesting. And certainly with The Matador and with this Bosnian movie, they were both sort of written that way. And I really enjoyed it. So I've kind of, as I get a little older, I've just sort of tried to just mix it up a little bit and do things that are just different and see, because, you know, for years I sort of just followed the rules and I wasn't really breaking through to be writing anything that brilliant or that interesting. And I don't know if I've done any of that since then, but I just really wanted to just shake it up a bit. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of the way that I go about writing these days. That and I have to write 5 pages a day, whether it's good or bad.
Oh, is that just an own personal goal?
That's right. I think it's a great way to actually finish something. I think a lot of people spend, you know, 3 months on the first 10 pages and then give up. And I'd rather at least get a draft of something and then see, you know, see what kind of shit it is, but then be able to rewrite it and hopefully make it interesting.
That's great.
That is great.
That's a great method.
Yes, it is. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Awesome. You guys are great. Thank you very much.
Have a good night, Richard.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Yay! Shepard letting us know all about The Matador and his new movie, which will not be called Spring Break in Bosnia.
Yes, but we're all going to lovingly refer to it as that until then.
Until we have a new title, that's
there
true. I'll be honest. I think that's a really cool title.
I do, too. Probably a little long, maybe.
Maybe a little long. Probably a little too different for the regular screening public. Perhaps.
Also, I'd like to mention the female aspect of this interview, where Richard Shepard seems to be a little haughty.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, you hadn't seen a picture of him until just now?
No, I'd seen a picture of him before.
Okay.
And thought the same thing. You know, kind of in the older Rob, not older, but prior Robert Downey Jr. type of category.
Oh, okay, okay. I would say, I think he's a little bit younger than Robert Downey Jr.
No, no, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, when Robert Downey Jr. was younger, also, or a Johnny Depp type of, like, same category.
And also happily married.
I know, and she, his wife, does a little cameo in the movie.
Yes, does a cameo in The Matador.
She's, like, drinking a beer or something, which is really cool, which is what you should do for me if that ever should happen to you.
So when Road to Atlantic City goes into production, I should cast you in a very small role, is what you're saying.
A very small role, yes.
Oh, okay, I'll work on that.
But something wacky.
Okay. Now, do you want to get back to dissecting Black Snake Moan, or would you rather go ahead and talk about the box office?
Well, let's get into the box office. We can discuss Black Snake Moan tomorrow.
Okay. All right.
If we don't, I mean, maybe we'll fly through the box office.
Do we ever fly through the box? No one takes as much time reading the damn box office report as we do. And although, you know what? I have to say, a lot of times we do that because, you know, we ain't got nothing else going on.
That's true.
Right? So, anyway. Someone is asking me now a question about Richard Shepard, so I'm going to send a link, and then I'm going to get back to, what is it we do here? A show?
We do pop culture stuff, which entails movies, and now we're going to do the box office report.
Thank you very much.
Is that enough?
That's enough. Let's do 10 tonight, since we're running out of time, okay?
All right, although I'd like to start at 13, because I really wanted to see that today.
All right, well, go ahead. Bust it out. Number 13 is?
Breach.
Breach, which is number 9 last week, so it's already out of the top 10, which means it's falling.
But we wanted to help it today, but we missed it by like 10 minutes.
That's right. That's why I ended up seeing Black Snake Moan, which, by the way, I would like to point out, Black Snake Moan is number 18 this week.
Well, we helped it out a little bit.
Yes, yes. But here's a movie with a very small investment. It only cost $15 million to make, right? This week, and it's only its third week, number 18 has made less than a million, made $641,000 this week, and has made a total of $8 million.
So that's going to be probably a loss.
That's probably looking like a loss. Breach, they're not telling you how much it costs, but they've taken in $31 million. Number 10 this week is Music and Lyrics. Last week it was number 8, $2.2 million for a nice 47. And like I say, those people should be happy that they're finishing near 50. Just my opinion. Number 9, Norbit. Finally falling its way out of the top 10, as critics hate it, but the public seems to like it, $2.7 million. It has made 92 overall. It only cost 60, so they're doing all right. Number 8 this week is a movie Jessica's not a big fan of, but I am a big fan of, Zodiac. It took in $3 million. It so far has taken in only 28. It cost 65. It's not looking that great as far as the profit on these people.
You know what? Here's another case. It probably have the critics probably love it, but the audience doesn't.
That probably is the case.
I hate being a part of the majority.
That's okay. Sometimes, you know what? Sometimes that happens. Every once in a while, you know, you find yourself sitting with the mainstream, and that there's nothing wrong with that.
You know what, though?
What?
I don't like American Pie movies.
Okay.
So that makes me
Does that make you feel better about yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. Number 7 this week is Ghost Rider. It was number 4 last week. It's taken in $4 million. It's taken in 110 overall, and it cost 110.
That looks like a profit of $202,000.
Oh, yeah, but they probably spent about $25 million to advertise it.
Wow.
So they have a way to go. But let's just say worldwide it'll probably be fine. Number 6 is Bridge to Terabithia.
Bridge to Fantasyland.
Yes, Bridge to lands that I don't like to go to, really. $5.1 million this week, 74 overall, which I think is fantastic for that film. It has no stars, and it has a small built-in audience because it's based on some book or something.
Well, you know what, though? How many children's movies are out there right now, Dan?
Let's see. I don't see any others in the top 10.
Okay. So, in other words, when you have your daughter in it this weekend, and you've got something to do.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, yeah, that's
what
I'm doing.
Going to the movie?
Yes, I'll be going to see Bridge to Terabithia.
Exactly.
Yes. Number 5 this week is a new movie. I think I Love My Wife, which could also be applied. You could also call that, like the subtitle for that could be The Radio Dan Story.
Oh, funny.
5.7 this week, which is 5.7 overall. They're not telling us how much it cost. It probably didn't cost that much, but they were probably hoping for more than 5.7.
Hush you.
Number four this week is also a new movie, Dead Silence, with a bunch of ventriloquist dolls killing people. $7.7 million, and it only cost 20, so, you know, we'll see. What are you going to do? This movie looks so stupid to me.
Oh, my God. I can't even.
It looks ridiculously dumb. She has, what, 100 ventriloquist dolls? This woman who, I guess she died some untimely death, and now all of her dolls are going to go ahead and kill people and cut out tongues or something. Number three this week is also a new movie. It's the last new movie of the week. It's Premonition with Sandra Bullock and Julianne McMahon. It took in $18 million, which is very nice for that movie, I think, because it only cost $20
million. I know. That movie's like, see, look what we do. We keep it nice, short, sweet, and we make our money back.
Number two this week. I am so shocked.
I am shocked at the
overall success of this film.
I am utterly shocked at the success of this film.
Wild Hogs is the movie that just don't quit. It is, for the third week in a row, number two, which
I'm
is
telling
fine.
You, I think the producers of this movie keep buying up tickets.
Wait, was it? Did it debut at number three? Or did it debut at number one?
It debuted at number one.
It did. Okay.
Recall seeing the number one movie in America.
Right. Okay. So it's number two this week. It was number two last week. It took in another $18.8 million. It's taken in 103 overall. They're not telling us what it cost, although maybe we can find out. You want to find out how much it cost?
Oh, you think you can find out?
I may have a way to find out how much it costs. Remember back when we were talking about Night at the Museum, and that budget was never out there. But I know, I found out it cost $110 million. See,
how
I knew
much
it cost.
Take in? Like $300 million?
$250 or something like that. Let's see if we can find out. Looks like they're not telling us here either. Oh, well. There goes my main.
Wait, go back up. What was that number?
That's the gross so far. The $106 million that's made so far. Oh, well, I guess I was a little too eager in that.
Maybe
sorry
you can
about
find
that.
Out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, who knows. Anyway, and also as we wrap up another exciting episode of the Radio Dan Show, the number one movie this week, as it was last week, $31 million, a total of $127 million in 2 weeks. It's $300 million.
Already doubled its...
It has just about doubled.
Just about.
Yes, probably by Tuesday it will have doubled its budget.
Well, we'll probably see it sometime this week. I'd like to see
really?
Movies all week. Yeah.
You'd like to see that? Because, you know, I was eager to... I was thinking about
going
to see that because...
I don't want
to
see that.
Oh, you don't?
I think that will be too bloody for me.
You're such a baby. Oh, look, we have an obligation to the public to see movies like 300. It's the number one movie in the land for 2 weeks in a row, and it's gangbusters. It's got good reviews. What's wrong with you?
I don't know.
Oh, you keep it up. There's going to be a new intern.
Sorry.
Okay, I'm just kidding. There could never be a new intern.
Oh, that's new.
Anyway, thanks to everybody out there who listened to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to make a couple of Talk Radio X programming notes real quick before we go. There is now a Talk Radio X toolbar. If you go to our homepage, talkradiox.com, you can download that. It's got no adware, no spyware, and you can listen to the station right there on your toolbar. So you go out and do all your browsing business, but still listen to the Radio Dan Show and the live test show. Also, tomorrow we are starting a new time. We are starting at 8 p.m. It'll be our first day tomorrow doing that. I'm very excited about doing that, going off.
Also, I have to say before the time ends that, unfortunately, I won't be around Tuesday.
Yes, Jessica will be off Tuesday night, so that we will have to push back the DVD releases this week to Wednesday. Matt Fox of Shai Halud will be on with us Thursday night, although he was supposed to do that before, so let's see if that happens. But that's what's coming up then. We have new shows starting this week. It's Wolf on the Air. It's Jeff Allen Wolf. He does a political talk show, Talk Radio X, that will be on 3 p.m. 3 p.m. to 6, you can hear that.
Awesome.
And this Friday we're starting...
Does he accept calls?
Yeah, I believe he does accept calls, but I'm not sure what number you would call for him. I don't think he is on the same Talk Radio X line that we're on.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, go to TalkRadioX.com for all of your Talk Radio X information. There's also a new show starting on Friday, but I don't know the name of it.
Okay.
So, thanks to Richard Shepard for joining us tonight, and we will be with you tomorrow. And say good night, Jessica.
Good night, Jessica.
Yeah, man. yamma, 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 whoopee-doo, Scooby-Doo, and gobbledygook.